Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the podcast where we take a stack of sources and really pull out the key insights to get you properly informed.
That's the plan.
And today, well, we're diving into something pretty intriguing, a real historical mystery asking. Anglo-Saxon kings, powerful nuns, and, well, alleged illicit relationships.
It definitely catches your attention. It's a glimpse into early medieval England that feels almost scandalous.
Exactly. So our focus for this deep dive is the Lost Kingdom of Mercia.
A real powerhouse in its day. We're talking 6th to 9th centuries, central to early medieval England, rich culture, lots of political maneuvering, military strength. It had it all.
Right. And our mission, yours and mine, is to sift through the historical accounts, the chronicles, the articles we've got, and help you understand the power dynamics, the societal norms, and yeah, those controversial stories about Mercian rulers and religious figures.
And we're drawing on some heavy hitters for sources, things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
Which wasn't just one book, right? Compiled over time in different places.
Exactly. Different monastic centers added to it. And of course, the writings of Bede. His ecclesiastical history is crucial, even if, you know, you have to read it with an eye on his own perspective. It gives us the backdrop for all this speculation.
Okay, so let's set the scene. The Anglo-Saxon period, where do we even start?
Well, think roughly 5th century up to 1066, the Norman conquest. It kicks off with tribes like the Angles, Saxons, Jutes arriving. But the really transformative thing, especially for Mercia, is the shift from paganism to Christianity.
Starting late 6th century. With people like St. Augustine.
That's right. And this wasn't just about changing gods. It fundamentally reshaped society. It introduced a whole new moral framework, a powerful institution, the church, that kings then had to navigate. It created this really complex dance between divine legitimacy and raw political power.
And Anglo-Saxon society itself was, well, very structured. Layered.
Oh, definitely hierarchical. You've got kings at the very top, then the nobility, the thanes, then freemen, churls, and below them serfs and slaves.
Right.
And constant jostling for power between the big kingdoms, Mercia, Northumbria, Wessex.
Always. They were constantly vying for supremacy for the title of Bretwalda, or overlord. And Mercia's location was key here.
Smack bang in the middle, right? Yeah. Covering areas like modern Staffordshire, Derbyshire, bits of Northamptonshire, Warwickshire.
Exactly. A strategic heartland. Which brings us to some of its key rulers. You really see Mercia's strength through them.
Like King Penda.
Yeah, Penda. He reigned mid-7th century, roughly 626 to 655.
Yeah.
A formidable warrior king, and interestingly, a staunch pagan.
So he resisted Christianity.
Fiercely. He really pushed back against its spread, particularly from Northumbria. Penda made Mercia a force to be reckoned with, built on, let's say, traditional warrior values.
Okay, and then later on you get King Offa. He sounds like a really big deal.
Oh, Offa's reign from about 757 to 796 is considered Mercia's absolute peak, its zenith.
Right, so what did he do? I know about Offa's dike.
Yes, the dike is huge. That massive earthwork marking the boundary with the Welsh kingdoms. A huge statement of power and control. But he did much more. Ambitious reforms, introducing the Offa coinage.
Ah, the silver pennies, standardized currency.
Exactly. That was massive for trade, for the economy, for Mercia's prestige across England and even into Europe. He was dealing with Charlemagne, you know?
Wow. So quite sophisticated for the time.
Very. Offa was brilliant at blending that older Mercian military power with the newer structures offered by the church and more organized governance. He wasn't just building territory. He was laying groundwork for something more like a unified kingdom using smart economics and diplomacy.
That blend, it leads nicely into the church's growing influence, doesn't it?
Perfectly. As Christianity took hold, the church just became this incredibly powerful institution. It wasn't separate from the state. It was deeply intertwined.
So kings wanted the church on their side for legitimacy.
Absolutely. Divine endorsement was powerful. Kings relied on bishops and abbots for counsel, for administration, remember. Churchmen were often the most educated people around, and yes, for that stamp of divine approval. This relationship really shaped how kingdoms were run, what society valued.
And within this church structure, you had nuns. What was their role like in Anglo-Saxon England?
It's a really fascinating picture. They lived in convents or nunneries, dedicated lives, prayer, service, community. Rigorous routine.
It wasn't just prayer, was it? You mentioned they had influence beyond the walls.
Yeah, definitely. Many convents were involved in charitable work, sometimes local education. They were part of the community fabric.
And for the women themselves. In a society where women were often, you know, subordinate.
That's the interesting paradox. Becoming a nun could actually offer women a degree of autonomy and respect that was hard to find elsewhere.
Really? How so?
Well, nuns, especially abbesses who ran the convents, could control property, wield significant local influence, even act as advisors. If a nun came from a powerful noble family, her connections and status didn't just disappear. Some high-status nuns were definitely players in local, even regional, politics. The convent was one of the few places a woman could exercise real agency.
And here's the core of the mystery we started with. There's that fundamental commitment to celibacy. Purity, devotion, central to their identity.
Absolutely critical. It was the bedrock of their spiritual life and status.
Yet the historical whispers the sources hint at, well, sporadic instances of sexual transgressions, often involving powerful men, kings even. How do we square that circle?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it brings us to these controversial allegations. The historical accounts, the chronicle, Bede, other letters and charters, they provide the setting. They mention interactions, royal visits to convents, kings founding or patronizing specific nunneries.
But they don't spell out affairs, do they?
Rarely explicitly. The language is often veiled, ambiguous. But historians look at patterns. Unusually frequent royal visits, exceptional gifts or favor shown to certain abbesses or nuns. Sometimes these are interpreted as hinting at relationships that went beyond, let's say, purely spiritual guidance or patronage.
And King Ulfa comes up again here, specifically.
He does. His documented links to religious institutions are strong. And some interpretations of the sources suggest nuns were sometimes present at the royal court, which should foster relationships beyond simple patronage. It's speculative, of course, based on interpretation.
It feels, well, uncomfortable given their vows.
It absolutely does. And that's why the credibility of these hints is constantly debated by historians. Some sources might be later gossip, some might be politically motivated slander. But the persistence of these kinds of suggestions,
yeah,
it tells us something.
What does it tell us?
Perhaps less about specific confirmed affairs and more about the complex, sometimes precarious position of the church. It was a powerful ally to kings, but its moral authority could potentially be compromised by the very rulers it sought to legitimize. And it always raises that question of power dynamics.
Right. Were these interactions, if they happened, consensual? Or was it about the coercive power kings held, that imbalance?
Exactly. A king's interest, even his favor, could be very difficult for anyone, even an abbess, to refuse outright. It's a critical lens.
And this idea of influence, it wasn't just personal or potentially scandalous. Monastic life itself was deeply political, wasn't it?
Hugely. Monasteries and convents weren't just quiet retreats. They were major landowners, centers of learning, and, yes, crucial political entities.
How so? Providing educated people.
Yes, providing educated clerics who could serve as advisors, administrators, record keepers for the royal court. They often held considerable sway over political decisions simply because they were the ones writing things down, offering counsel.
So there was a kind of mutual benefit going on between kings and monasteries.
Definitely. A symbiotic relationship. Kings granted land, wealth, privileges to monasteries. This secured loyalty, it burnished the king's reputation for piety, gained public goodwill, and ensured prayers were said for the king and kingdom, which was genuinely important to them.
A strategic investment, almost.
In many ways, yes. It cemented alliances, stabilized regions. Monastic influence was woven right into the political fabric.
Okay, so if the church and its institutions were so integral, so powerful, how did they handle situations where moral codes were breached, especially by the king and potentially involving nuns? That seems like a massive problem.
It was a huge problem. A king transgressing with a nun wasn't just a personal sin. It was seen as a grave breach of his duty, undermining the very divine order he was supposed to uphold.
So what did the church authorities do?
Well, they were the guardians of morality. They had to enforce strict codes, especially around sexual conduct, and hold rulers accountable. But they also had a very strong institutional interest in protecting their own reputation.
Meaning suppression.
Often, yes. The church aimed to maintain the sanctity, or at least the public perception of sanctity, of its institutions. Scandals involving kings and nuns were incredibly damaging. They risked the king's authority, divine favor, the stability of the kingdom, and the church's own standing. So keeping things quiet, dealing with them internally, that was often preferable to public exposure.
Were there consequences if a ruler was found culpable?
Oh, yes. Depending on the severity and the politics, consequences could be severe. Public penance, loss of prestige, challenges to their legitimacy, even, in extreme cases, pressure leading to exile or abdication. You didn't cross the church lightly, even as king.
It really makes you think about the whispers, the things not written down.
Exactly. The stories that might have circulated in those courts and cloisters were piecing together fragments.
Which brings us to how later generations saw all this. How have these stories been interpreted, say, centuries later?
That's another fascinating layer. Later scholars, writers, chroniclers, they often looked back at these accounts and, well, reinterpreted them. Sometimes romanticized, sometimes sensationalized.
Injecting their own values.
Precisely. Projecting later ideas about romance, power, sexuality onto the Anglo-Saxon past. Modern interests don't always map neatly onto medieval realities.
So the narratives get shaped by the teller.
Absolutely. Later chroniclers might impose their own moral frameworks. Depending on the writer's agenda, an interaction could be framed as piety, a king supporting a holy woman, or as seduction and transgression. A cautionary tale, perhaps.
And these embellishments, where do they come from? Church agendas? Just good storytelling?
A mix of things, probably. Ecclesiastical writers might use stories to reinforce moral lessons. Sometimes it might just be the appeal of a dramatic story involving power, faith, and forbidden liaisons. Sensationalism isn't exactly new.
So this interplay of fact-fiction interpretation, it's why scholars are still debating the accuracy of it all.
Exactly. It's a constant process of re-evaluating the sources, understanding the context they were written in, and trying to separate potential historical reality from later narrative shaping.
Okay, so wrapping this up. Mercia's history, especially this intertwining of the monarchy and the church, it's a really complex picture.
It truly is. A fascinating tapestry. And those rumored liaisons with nuns, however sensationalized they might have become, they do offer a unique window. A lens to look at the broader societal norms, the pressures, the intricate power games of the time.
Yeah, this whole deep dive really highlights how blurred the lines were back then. Mm-hmm. Power, influence, piety, personal relationships. It wasn't all neatly separated.
Not at all. Which makes Mercian history so vivid, so compelling, and why it still engages us today.
It absolutely does.
And maybe that leaves us with a final thought for you, the listener, to ponder. This enduring fascination we seem to have with these kinds of stories, stories of power, faith, alleged transgression, what does that tell us about human nature? About how societies, then and now, grapple with moral boundaries?
And maybe also, how much do these historical narratives, shaped and reshaped by their tellers over centuries, continue to influence how we actually understand the past today? Something to think about.